The following is an excerpt from the Science Magazine podcast. To hear the whole show, visit www.sciencemag.org and click on Science Podcast.
Now, David Grimm, Science's online news editor, is here with a wrap-up of some of the latest science news from our online daily news site, Science Now, including a story about whether or not we need the moon. Dave, I didn't think we had a choice.
We don't have a choice, but if we did, Rob, we made the right one, because the moon is thought to have a very stabilizing effect on our planet's climate. And that's because our moon is actually very large. And because it's so large, it exerts a large amount of gravity on Earth. And this gravitational tug counteracts a lot of the gravitational disturbances that Earth would feel from Venus and even the much more massive Jupiter. And these disturbances without the moon could have an effect on the tilt of our axis, which could have devastating effects for Earth's climate. And in fact, that's what scientists think happened with Mars. Mars has a couple of moons, but they're very small moons. And because of this, scientists think that Mars's axial tilt has varied between 10 degrees and 60 degrees in the past, which has caused huge climate variations that could have in turn contributed to the loss of most of the planet's atmosphere, leaving Mars the bone-dry desert world that it is today. Obviously, that hasn't happened on Earth, and scientists attribute a lot of that to our large moon.
So is this some kind of modeling study then?
Well, so the idea behind the study was to figure out, well, is this actually true? Is the moon really that important for the habitability of Earth and hence life on Earth? And the reason scientists care about this is because, you know, we keep on looking out there to the cosmos for other life-bearing worlds. And the thinking goes that, you know, if we find an Earth-like planet, it's probably only going to be habitable if it has a large moon like ours. And the scientists in this new study wanted to figure out, is that really true? Do these planets really need these big moons to be habitable? And it's a modeling study. They did some calculations. And what they found, actually, which was surprising, was that the moon actually isn't that important for keeping the tilt of our axis stable. It is important in the long run over billions of years. Not having the moon, researchers found, would have changed the tilt of the axis of Earth. But over billions of years, I mean, that's a huge time frame. I mean, life, so much life has evolved over billions of years that if the axis of the Earth isn't going to change radically over that time, then life would still have plenty of time to evolve.
So do researchers have any idea about how many more planets might be habitable given that they don't have to have a large moon?
Yeah, they do. They're basically saying that based on these data, that the number of habitable planets out there might be 10 times greater than we had initially thought. So this could have a really big impact for researchers that are looking for life beyond our solar system.
Okay, well, thanks, Dave. So what other stories have we brought with you this week?
Well, Rob, we dealt a lot with size in that last story, the idea that we would need this very large moon to sustain life on Earth and potentially other worlds. This next story also deals with size, but it deals with how we actually perceive size. In the famous story Gulliver's Travels, Gulliver, when he lands on the island of Lilliput, he, as many people know, encounters a bunch of tiny people. Well, according to Gulliver, he's not a giant. He didn't get any bigger. It's just that the people around him are incredibly small. And this gets to an important question in biology, which is, how do we perceive the world around us? If we see objects grow and shrink, do we feel that we are getting bigger and smaller, or that the object is getting bigger and smaller? It's sort of, how do we use our body as sort of a metric to judge the size of the rest of the world?
So how do you test that, Dave?
Well, it's a really good question. And to answer it, the scientists devised a very ingenious experiment. What they did was they recruited about 200 volunteers, and they had them lie down with their legs in front of them so they could see their legs. And then each volunteer put a headset over their eyes that played a closed-circuit video of the legs of an adjacent mannequin. So even though their heads are sort of looking at their legs, what they're seeing with their eyes is actually the legs of this mannequin that is next to them. And then using either their fingers or a stick, the researchers would touch the volunteer's leg, and then they would touch the leg of the mannequin. So the volunteers are seeing the mannequin leg being touched, but they're feeling their own leg being touched. Now, this may all sound very complicated, but the end result of this setup for the experiment is to make the subjects believe that the mannequin's legs are actually their own legs. In fact, the illusion works so well that when one of the researchers pulled out a knife and began cutting the mannequin's legs, the volunteers began to sweat.
This does not sound like an experiment I would want to volunteer for, Dave.
Well, the knife cutting was just sort of an aside. I mean, basically what the researchers were trying to do was to get these volunteers used to thinking about these mannequin legs as their own, because what they did next was they started to vary the size of these legs. All of a sudden, the subjects saw these mannequin legs, which they began to believe were their own legs, grow really large, up to 400 centimeters long, or really small, only 30 centimeters long. And the first thing the researchers did after they did this was they dangled a block in front of the subjects and they asked them to describe how big it was using both words and gestures. And if the subjects' new legs were incredibly tiny, they tended to overestimate the size of the block, where if their legs were really large, they tended to underestimate the size of the block. But what was even more interesting was that the researchers then pointed to an object like a chair and they asked the subjects to stand up and walk over to the object.
So they're on their own legs.
They're on their own legs, but they've got their eyes closed. So they're still believing in the mannequin legs that they've been given. And those that have been given very big legs took only a few short steps to the chair, thinking, you know, that they had these giant strides and can make it to the chair very quickly, and of course ran short of the chair. And those that had been given these teeny weeny legs took a lot of steps and overshot the chair. And this all sounds like a fun experiment, but it gets back to that original question of how do we perceive the world? And what these experiments show is that we perceive our bodies as a constant and the world around us as changing. So we use our own bodies as a metric. And as Gulliver had imagined, he had never changed size. It was the people around him that had grown very small. And the researchers say this could explain why, for example, if you go back to pick up a toy from your childhood, or maybe you go back to a classroom in elementary school and you go, wow, these desks and these chairs are so small. I can't believe how small they are. You know, you're sort of using your body as a reference and saying, on a certain level, you're sort of thinking, well, I haven't really changed size over this amount of time. Everything else has gotten smaller. And that's obviously really not the case, but it just gives us a sense of how we perceive the world around us.
Other than a confirmation of how we judge things around us, are there any other applications to this study?
Well, you could think of the movie Avatar, where a subject's mind is put into another body. Obviously, scientists aren't anywhere near doing that yet, but it could help scientists design humanoid robots that we're able to control with our own body. And you can be controlling it with your body maybe from afar, but it would be really important to intuit how that robot's size fits into the world. You don't want to be making the same mistake that the volunteers made with these chairs by overestimating or underestimating certain movements or gestures. The more scientists learn about this, the more they can design these kind of cool gee whiz applications.
Okay, so last story. What's this last one about?
Well, Rob, this last story also deals a bit with our perception of the world, and it has to do with ethical and moral dilemmas. Let me give you an example. You're standing on a busy street, and there's a runaway trolley that comes towards you. You see it's about to kill five people. It's just about to run them right over. You can stop the trolley if you push a very large man who's standing right in front of you in the path of the trolley. Now, that's going to kill the man, but it will stop the trolley and save the five people. Do you do it?
This seems really contrived.
It does seem really contrived. I mean, how many of us are actually going to encounter a runaway trolley in our real lives? And that's been the problem with these kinds of setups. When researchers investigate these dilemmas, they're trying to figure out, you know, why do we make the moral choices we do? Is it something we've learned, some sort of philosophy we've gained over our lives? Some studies have shown that it's actually just based on differences in our brain structure. If part of the brain is bigger than another part of the brain, we tend to make more so-called utilitarian choices, which would be killing the one man to save the five. You know, what is it all chalked up to? Why do we make the decisions we do? But as you rightly pointed out, Rob, if you use an example like this, researchers may not be getting accurate results because it's not, for most of us, this is not an example we would encounter in our everyday lives. And so this new study, researchers tried to find something that would be more applicable to a person's everyday life. So they recruited a bunch of doctors and healthcare professionals. And by healthcare professionals, I mean people that don't see patients, but who may manage a health resource like Medicare or some large health program. And what they wanted to see is, could they give these people a moral dilemma from their professional lives? And would they respond the same as they would to a more contrived dilemma like the runaway trolley example.
So what's an example of one of these more realistic scenarios?
Well, for a doctor, suppose she has a patient that's hooked up to five different machines. One's maybe supplying oxygen, and one is very important liquids that this patient's getting over IV, and a few other machines. But then she turns to the other side of the room, and she's got five patients that each individually could benefit from one of those machines that could save their lives. But if she pulled those machines off this one patient, that patient's going to die. Or, for example, something that had sort of more of a financial angle to it. If a doctor has a limited amount of money to work with and she can decide to save a few lives with some very expensive treatments, and she can save those lives right now, or she could save that money, costing those people's lives, but use it to maybe distribute a bunch of preventative tests, which would save many more lives, not immediately, but down the line. You know, these are situations that aren't too different from what a doctor would face during his or her actual career. And what the researchers found was that there was a big difference between the way the doctors responded to these moral dilemmas versus the way public health professionals respond to these dilemmas. The doctors tended to focus on the immediate. So for example, only about a third of the doctors that took part in the study were willing to pull the plug on a patient's life support to save others, versus nearly half of public healthcare professionals were willing to pull the plug to save a bunch more lives down the line. And these responses are actually very similar to the way both groups responded to the very contrived dilemma of the runaway trolley. The doctors were much less likely to push that man in front of the trolley to save the five other people on the street, where the public healthcare workers were thinking more of the five people on the street. And it makes a lot of sense when you think about the different ways that these people are trained. The doctors have to take this Hippocratic oath, which basically says, I can do no harm to my patient. And so it sort of goes against their training to pull the plug on a patient that they're trying to save, even if from a utilitarian point of view, it makes sense because they could save more patients in the long run, where the public healthcare workers are really focused on the population at large. And for them, you know, the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few.
So are they chalking it up to this training, or are they saying, well, doctors are people before they become doctors and are more likely to become doctors because they have this view already?
Well, that's the really interesting question that arises out of this research. You know, really gets back to this idea of why do we make these choices in the first place? Do we make them because we've learned something throughout our lives that makes us make certain choices over the other? Or are we sort of hardwired to make these sort of decisions? And that would get back to the idea that maybe it has something to do with the relative size of certain brain structures. But what the researchers are concluding based on this, they don't have the answer to any of those questions, but they at least do know based on this study that, you know, the contrived examples may work as well as a real world example. You know, these people are, you either have people that are going to make a very utilitarian decision, or you have people that are going to make sort of the more immediate decision to save one life, even though it could cost several lives down the line. And just to get back to your question, Rob, the researchers say the next study they'd like to do is to track public health professionals before and after their training, and also doctors, to figure out if the training is what's influencing these decisions, or whether it's just the type of person that goes into these fields that may be hardwired to make those decisions in the first place.
Okay. Well, thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Rob.
So what other stories are you looking into for the site?
Well, Rob, for Science Now, we've got a couple of stories on our early ancestors. One story about the origins of farming, which was incredibly important to the development of human civilization, when and where that got started. Also a story about 2 million-year-old human ancestors known as Australopithecines, and how the males tended to stay close to home while the females ranged far and wide to find a mate. New insights into the social structure of some of our early relatives. For Science Insider, Science's policy blog, we've got a story about the link between cell phones and cancer. The World Health Organization has just come out with a big report, and we've got an analysis of that on Insider. Also, a story about what NASA is going to be up to in 2020. And finally, on Science Live, our weekly chat on the hottest topics in science, this week's chat's about the importance of failure in science, why sometimes disastrous experiments lead to scientific breakthroughs. So be sure to check out all of this on the site.
David Grimm is the online news editor of Science. You can check out the latest science news, plus all the stories on the Science Policy blog, Science Insider, and join a live chat, Science Live, on the hottest science topics every Thursday at 3 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time. Find it all at news.sciencemag.org.